Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Along with Jim Garrity of National Review, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And Jim, we start with a good martini that broke overnight. We've had a lot of good buddy cop TV shows and movies over the years. Lethal Weapon with Riggs and Murtaugh, 48 Hours, Tango and Cash, Naked Gun, which we referenced a couple of times here. On the TV side, you had Starsky and Hutch, Cagney and Lacey, Ponch and John. This is the Chips theme. But now on the Republican side, it's Cruz and Kasich, at least in three states, agreeing for one to back away so the other has a chance to get more delegates to keep Donald Trump away from that magic number of 1237. Essentially, the agreement is for Kasich to back off in Indiana, where Cruz looks to be the stronger candidate, and in return, Cruz will back off in Oregon and New Mexico. Not surprisingly, this deal that is struck is being condemned by the great deal maker himself, Donald Trump, who says collusion is often illegal in many other industries, and yet these two Washington insiders have had to revert to collusion in order to stay alive, not pointing out that this type of collusion is not in any way a violation of the law. So, Jim, what do you make of the buddy cop movie in the effort to keep Donald Trump out of the magic number?
First of all, Greg, bravo to you for the sound clip of that. I'm stealing that. And I really do think Ted Cruz is the Eric Estrada of this this election cycle. Was it Larry
Wilcox?
I can't remember who John was.
Larry
anyway,
Wilcox.
Everybody only remembers Ponch. But by the way, if you can't remember the other guy, that's a good metaphor for John Kasich right there. So here's the thing. On the one hand, the anti-Trump crowd should be saying, hooray, good for these guys. But there's a little bit of an element of, guys, what took you so long? That basically, this has kind of been a bunch of these states, it's been pretty clear that if you're in that, you know, 10, 15%, your chances of magically gaining another 20, 30% in the next couple of days are not looking all that great. And in light of this, I think it's fair to ask, did Ted Cruz really need to make a push for New York? Was it time well spent? Was it money well spent? He was a very distant third. Did Kasich really need to make his push in Wisconsin, Utah, and Arizona? Now, you can say that, you know, Cruz ended up with more of the Arizona was winner take all. But in Wisconsin, you know, Cruz got plenty of delegates. But ultimately, the argument against Trump for a long time was, well, okay, he's doing really well, but there's 17 candidates. Okay, he's doing really well, but he's still up against 10. Well, now we're down to three. And to give credit to Trump, he won very big in his home state of New York State. And he's still doing quite well. The outlook is very good for him in all the states voting tomorrow on Tuesday. The polling has him still ahead in Indiana. And while it's very tough to get a real sense of how the delegates are going to shake out district by district in California, the overall state polling puts Trump ahead in California. So Trump is actually in pretty darn good shape right now. Probably not enough to get to the 1,237 delegates he needs, but he's probably going to finish pretty darn close to it. Is it doing any of these guys any good? Well, could either of these guys have beaten Trump one-on-one instead of it being this, you know, have this three-way race in which they're splitting the non-Trump vote? Well, Indiana gives us a sense of this. There's a Fox poll that said, look, how do you feel about it? It's Trump 41, Cruz 33, Kasich 16. This is one of those states where Kasich is kind of laying back, although he said apparently right before we came on air, Greg, the people who support him should vote for him. On the one hand, like, you shouldn't say, hey, you love me, don't vote for me, right? On the one hand, no candidate's going to turn down votes. On the other hand, if you believe in strategic voting, then obviously you should be supporting Cruz out there. If you allocate the second choice for all the Kasich people, it comes out to Trump 45, Cruz 42. Not quite enough to put him over the top. Now, Trump doesn't do that well compared. He doesn't overperform his polls very often. He did it in New York State, his home state, but otherwise, polling generally gets it pretty good. The late people who are undecided tend to pick one of the other options. So it's possible Cruz wins Indiana, but you're still looking at probably a floor of 45 or so for Trump in Indiana. I don't know about you, Greg. I mean, if Indiana is not a Cruz state, you got to start asking, what are, you know, short of Texas? It seems like the kind of place he would match up very well. So good news for these guys. It feels like they were wasting effort against each other. It doesn't make a lot of sense for the guy in second and the guy in third to spend a lot of time beating each other up when the guy in first keeps racking up delegates. But the flip side is maybe a little late for these guys, and this might have done them some good. after the previous Super Tuesday, after Rubio dropped out.
On to the bad martini now, and we go back to a story from Friday, and Terry McAuliffe is the governor of Virginia, and those of us in Virginia shake our heads every day that it's not Ken Cuccinelli. And then we say, thanks, Robert Sarvis. Thanks a lot. But the big story from Terry McAuliffe on Friday, as he angles for a spot in the Clinton administration, is that he signed an executive order restoring the voting rights of over 200,000 ex-felons. I'll let him tell you in his own words what's going on here.
Today, I will sign an order restoring the civil and voting rights of every single individual who has completed his or her sentence as of this day, April 22nd, 2016. Let me be crystal clear. 206,000 Virginians will get their rights back to votes. These are folks who have served their time. They've completed their supervised probation or parole. They will immediately, in the next couple minutes, regain their right to vote, the right to run for office, and the right to serve on a jury.
Richmond.com says that the point of this is pretty clear already, because Governor McAuliffe essentially admitting that the sweeping action was aimed largely at rectifying Virginia's, quote, long and sad history, unquote, of suppressing African-American voting power. But here's where it really gets controversial. The governor's order applies to all violent and nonviolent felons who had finished their sentence and supervised release as of Friday, even those who have not applied for a restoration of rights. Previous Virginia governors have restored rights on an individual basis, but none has done it for an entire category of offenders with one pen stroke. And you've got some Republicans in the legislature saying the reason for that is it's unconstitutional, according to the Virginia Constitution. So, Jim, I know you're reluctant to think that Terry McAuliffe did this to boost Democratic turnout in November this year. What do you make of this bold move by our governor?
You know, this is why I hate Democrats. And at this point, Greg, I'm sure Media Matters is saying, aha, Jim hates Democrats because he hates, you know, letting people vote. No, there's a really legitimate argument that we can have here, that we should have here. That is, if you are a felon and you know, if you serve your time, should you be allowed to vote again? Under what circumstances? You know, you did your time, you're back in? Or do we feel like, no, if you've done something terrible, the state has the right to you've demonstrated you're an irresponsible person. You've demonstrated you're a dangerous person. You're a danger to others. And if we can't trust you with that, no, by the way, Terry McAuliffe keeps the firearm restrictions in place for all of these felons. If we don't trust you with a gun, why would we trust you with a vote? You know, one can be as dangerous as the other in the wrong hands. You've seen a good portion of conservatives saying, hey, you know what? Criminal justice system is not working the way we want it to. Too many people end up becoming lifelong criminals. We want people to be able to reenter society. We want people to be able to redeem themselves. We want people to go on to live productive lives. And at one point during his comments there, you didn't play the soundbite of this one, Greg, but apparently he said, I want you to feel good about yourselves again. Greg, I don't know about you. I'm not sure I want violent felons to feel good about themselves. I'm okay if they feel a little guilty and racked with regret and things like that. So if he had limited it to nonviolent offenders, I think you would have seen most people saying, okay, all right, there's a stronger case. Violent offenders, hey, you know what? You beat somebody, you rape somebody, I'm okay with taking away your right to vote. I think that's, you know, I don't think that's too mean. I don't think that's harsh, right? You've done something terrible here. So the fact that this is, you know, also, by the way, Greg, is it just me that I feel it sound like a campaign rally and that sound bright? You know, there's a lot of cheering, a lot of happiness there. No. Do the victims get any say? You know, maybe you should get your voting right if your victim says it's all right again.
That would be a good way.
Your victim should get two votes. How's that sound?
If they're still living. Yeah. And I'm sure, Jim, that the thing that convicted felons who are now free after serving their sentence really, really want is to be able to serve on jury duty, because that's what we all want every single day.
Well, I was going to say, they deserve a little more punishment, don't they? they're okay. Do you want to see the only good news for Virginia Republicans under this scenario, Greg?
What's that?
I guess Bob McDonald will get to vote.
I was just thinking Bob McDonald should have made a friend in the audiovisual industry, because the audio from that was not that great on the Capitol steps. He could have put in a much better sound system if he had had a friend in that area instead of the natural supplement business. But
you know, at some point now, all of our listeners in Nevada are saying, really? You guys make fun of us? Really?
Speaking of victims having a say, let's move on to the crazy martini, because the New York Times, which is, of course, known for their hard-hitting sports coverage, has decided that Americans, and especially football fans, you're just Bad people. John Branch, Jim reported on this in the Morning Jolt today, pro football columnist for the New York Times, writes, quote, "The NFL draft, our coverage of it, and our appetite for it is a cultural phenomenon. But it also shows, as much as any sporting event in this country does, how fans and leagues and even the players themselves in this age of social media are willing to dehumanize the games they love, turning people into products and lives into entertainment." Johnny Manziel is the latest example, playing out in real time as another draft approaches. To read online comments and social media posts about Manziel's troubles, arrests, parties, rehabilitation, is to explore the underbelly of fandom, dismissive and cruel. Schadenfreude is the flip side of reverence and perhaps a stronger attraction. So when you want, you know, the nitty gritty about how your O-line and D-line are shaping up in the draft, the New York Times is obviously where you want to go for that. Jim, Johnny Manziel, the guy who partied his way through college, the guy who should have gotten suspended more for the autograph scandal, but that looks like chump change now, considering his abuse of women. He just got indicted on a misdemeanor battery charge down in Texas. He basically didn't take his job in Cleveland seriously, so he got cut from the team after playing horribly when he did get on the field. But somehow it's our fault that this guy with all this talent is basically throwing it away.
Tisk tisk, NFL fans. Tisk tisk. How dare you dehumanize all these young men who are going to be struggling along on millions of dollars a year, you know, dealing with the pressure. Could you imagine the humiliation of being there in Chicago and sitting there in that green room and the TV cameras are on you, and sometimes you have to wait several hours before they call your name to announce that you'll be getting a multi-million dollar opportunity and a chance at stardom and greatness? Can you imagine that humiliation? Greg, I don't know. I actually think getting turned down for jobs is it's kind of standard in life. And most of it, yeah, we're not on national television for it. But almost every one of those guys, like I could be wrong, Greg. Can you recall anybody who's ever been in that waiting room who didn't get drafted?
Some have had to wait a very long time. But yeah, I mean, you usually don't show up unless you're pretty likely to go in at least
right?
the
you
first
know, like,
round
Geno
and a half.
Smith had to wait till the second day, you know, and then the real suffering began, like, with his teammate punching him in the jaw. But anyway, like. I'm sorry, I don't have a ton of sympathy for these young men. And for most of them, draft day is this really great, wonderful experience. And Johnny Manziel, look, it's not the NFL draft that gave Johnny Manziel his problems. It's not the dehumanizing process here. No, he made a bunch of bad decisions. As you put it very well, he partied his way through college, and then he went to the NFL. He got a giant contract, which is fairly standard when you're quarterback picked in the first round. And then he wasn't that good a player. And, you know, some of it was that he, you could argue about his size and things like that. But a lot of it also was that he kept partying during the week. He kept, you know, he did not have the work ethic. He did not have the dedication to the sport and improving himself and his craft. And anybody who watched the coverage of him for 2 years, his coaches were concerned about him. His teammates were concerned about him. Everybody kept emphasizing to him that, look, you're on the wrong path here. And every single time Johnny Manziel ignored them and then was seen in Las Vegas partying and stuff. Now he's got criminal charges. He apparently has a alleged misdemeanor assault. I think Johnny Manziel is probably one of the most unsympathetic guys in the world. And I don't feel guilty about making fun of him or pointing to him and say, you know, when I look at him, I say, don't be that. Don't do that. And I don't think when we do that, we're not bad people for saying, don't be like Johnny Manziel. And people say, oh, it's a tragic. I'm not so sure it's tragic. He was stupid. Right? You know, it's not that like lightning struck him and suddenly something bad happened to him. He made a series of bad decisions. And I kind of feel like this is kind of our cultural cleansing, right? This is the New York Times treating the concept of individual responsibility as a tackling dummy. The NFL fans, the draft, the expectations, they're not the cause of Johnny Manziel's problems. Johnny Manziel's problems are staring at him in the mirror every morning. It seemed like almost a parody of sports journalism and wanting to be a deep thinker and philosophical and all that kind of stuff by taking the deliberately iconoclast or disagreeable view to say, no, Johnny Manziel's not the problem. NFL fans who dehumanize people at the draft are the problem. No, they're not. And oh, by the way, nobody ever found the Boko Haram girls. So you can go, you know, write about that if you want, buddy.
Yeah, let's wring our hands about the treatment of Johnny Manziel. Drew Rosenhaus, I don't know how closely folks follow football, is one of the most ruthless agents out there. He cut ties with Johnny Manziel in the last couple of weeks because the guy was a train wreck and was probably not very profitable for him anymore. So if you've lost the guy who is completely based on revenue.
Well, as my pop culture podcast co-host Mickey White put it, man, when Drew Rosenhaus doesn't think he can make money off you. That's a sign, right? When Drew Rosenhaus, by the way, we should worth noting Drew Rosenhaus, who kind of has this reputation of being a really ruthless operator, said he was, you know, like before he dropped him as a client, he says, you have 5 days to get yourself into rehab. Otherwise, I'm dropping you as a client. And Manziel didn't do it. It's been pretty open that Manziel, you could argue whether he's an alcoholic. We can argue about whether he has other problems. But this is a guy who does not, turning into bed, studying the playbook and taking care of himself. You know, he's a professional athlete, right? His body is what is going to give him an opportunity for an amazing life and do amazing things and to be a role model for millions. And he's throwing it all away. And it's I was kind of struck to see the New York Times angrier at people moralizing about Johnny Manziel than they are at Johnny Manziel, which I think kind of represents the philosophy of the New York Times right then and there. So, you know, individual responsibility isn't just for political debates. I think it fits into these kind of cultural contexts as well, Greg.
I think our ultimate goal is for that to be the biggest disaster that comes out of Cleveland this year, right?
Ah, very good, Greg. Bring it full circle.
See you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today, and join us again on Tuesday for the next Three Martini Lunch.